And we're on.
And welcome everyone to a very special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and this week I'm actually joined by another one of our regular contributors, Tim Fuglay. And just wanted to say hello, Tim, and thanks for sitting in for Frank, who couldn't make it today, but we're going to have a really fun chat. We got a great guest.
Mm-hmm. Looking forward to it.
So tonight we're joined by veteran film editor Mick Audsley for a discussion on his absolutely amazing career. He's worked numerous times with filmmaker Stephen Frears, credits that include The Hit, My Beautiful Laundrette, Prick Up Your Ears, Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, Dangerous Liaisons, The Grifters, Hero, The Van, High Fidelity, Dirty Pretty Things, Tamara Drew, Lay the Favorite, and Muhammad Ali's Greatest Fight. He's also collaborated with director Mike Newell on Love in the Time of Cholera, Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, Mona Lisa Smile, and Prince of Persia. He's teamed up with director Neil Jordan on We Are No Angels, an Interview with the Vampire. And he's crafted multiple films with one of our favorite directors, Terry Gilliam, including sci-fi classic 12 Monkeys, The Zero Theorem, and The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. I've always loved that title. He also cut last...
I'm feeling tired listening to all that lot.
He cut last year's mountain climbing disaster film Everest, which was shot by our buddy Salvatore Totino. And his latest feature, which he co-edited with Jeremiah O'Driscoll, is the Robert Zemeckis-directed World War II film Allied, which hits theaters in November. We're very excited to check that out. And we're also very interested to learn more about his very cool personal venture, Sprocket Rocket Soho, which is a networking organization that he's created with his wife, which aims to bring filmmakers, actors, and craftspeople together online. Check it out at www.sprocketrocketsoho.com. Welcome to the show, Mick. Thanks so much. It's a total honor.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me on. I hope I can be articulate and tell you a little bit about what's been going on. Listening to that list of credits just made me feel a little bit tired.
That's a lot of work. That's quite a body of work.
Yeah,
it really is. Mick, just generally speaking, how did you get started in the industry? We'd love to hear about that.
Well, I was attracted to animation as an art student, in my school days, and I did go to an art school in Britain. But my sort of interest was in moving images, initially animation. I was always interested in music and sound as a sort of amateur musician. So slowly I realized that animation was rather a solitary existence, and I got more interested in the collaborative side of, conventional filmmaking. So I drifted towards an art school that would allow me to eventually go to one of the early film schools here in Britain in the early 70s. And I sort of ended up there. The one thing I didn't do as a film student, a postgrad film student for 3 years, was cut anything. I did all the other disciplines. I did a lot of sound because I was interested in sound recording and music and sound editing. But actually picture editing I didn't do until I left and was desperate to earn a living. And somebody just offered me something and kind of pushed me into it at the British Film Institute. And I ended up in the British Film Institute in the mid-70s, really, bluffing my way through as a picture editor who knew very little about anything much in that side of it. But I had the conceit of being able to, let's say, lie my way through out of my ignorance. And I was overnight attracted to picture editing. It suddenly hit me like a ton of bricks that this was where the real power of filmmaking was. So that's how I got started. A small 60 mil drama films for the British Film Institute.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Now, I did notice that you just kind of started off on the sound side. Do you still stay fairly involved in sound design, or is that really a different part of the crew for the most part for you?
It's something I'm, always been fascinated by and interested in, as I hope I've just explained. I feel as an architect of a film, which is what the sound and picture editing is, that it's impossible to let go of, say, the side where your ears are involved, you're involved in ears as well as eyes. So in a rudimentary way, I like to stay very involved and hand that over and get it enhanced and developed by the you know, all the talent that the sound designers bring to it. It's more a sort of economy of time and motion. You know, I'd love to be able to dub the films that I'd cut myself completely, but that's not possible in the strategy and scheduling of most movies. So what I like to do is to sketch it out in the early stages of picture editing, and then it's a conversation that goes on throughout the sound, well, through the picture editing side and through the montage and sound editing stages up to the final dub, and be involved in the dub. You know, it's all teamwork. Everything is teamwork in the cutting room for me.
Are there any particular films or editors that really stand out to you as being heavily influential on your style?
I'd like to think that the style of any film comes out of the material and the narrative content and the way the directors and all the other contributors create that movie that comes into the cutting room. So I'm a little bit suspicious of that word style. Because it sounds like it's like a box of tricks that you open up for each film and impose. I'd rather it came from the movie itself and its needs. But I have personalities and editors who have influenced me in the sense of them as personalities and their work methods, and they are certainly have been enormously supportive of my filmmaking life, namely the great legendary D.D. Allen, the wonderful, yeah, Walter Mersch.
Amazing.
Thelma Shoemaker, who I was lucky enough to work under, as it were, in the making of The Grifters all those years ago. She sort of helped in the finishing of The Grifters, so in conversations and support. Well, just saying, carry on, Mick. but coming from her, that meant a lot to me. So these people and these wonderful, talented filmmakers have influenced me in that way. So I hope that isn't so much as a style, but just ways of dealing with issues and problems and thinking behind the editorial process.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mick, obviously, your filmography speaks for itself, and we're going to sort of jump all over the place here coming up because there's lots of great movies you want to talk about. But first, we want to definitely address your newest film, which is set for release in about 6 weeks from now, maybe about 2 months, which is Allied. And one of the things that obviously initially intrigues, I think, a lot of people is that it's a Robert Zemeckis film. You've got two of the biggest stars in the world right now, Brad Pitt, Marion Cotillard. And this seemingly, from the trailers, looks like one of those old school Hollywood romance, action, war dramas that really don't seem to get made too often. And I wanted to find out about how you got involved, because you know, when you look at your filmography, you notice that you've worked with the same filmmakers repeatedly. Obviously, you know, creating great bonds there with these artists. And this, as far as I can tell, is your first time working with Zemeckis. So how did Allied come about for you?
Yeah, it's a fascinating and for me absolutely wonderful experience. What happened was that the film was being shot here in London, and Steve Starkey, who works with Bob Zemeckis as his longtime producer and collaborator and close friend, realized that in coming to Britain in February, that it was going to be very hard to meet the release date, which is your Thanksgiving in November, coming soon. Rather than poor Jeremiah, who is Bob's regular and wonderful film editor, rather than have him shoulder the entire burden of that, and it be a problem, you know, let's say in August or September now, Steve Starkey approached me to say, would I be interested in sharing the responsibility early on in the process, while the film was being shot, so that the burden of editing material, which was going to have visual effects and turnovers and all that pressure, to allow the VFX teams to complete their work satisfactorily, that we push ahead, the two of us, side by side. Was I interested in that? And I jumped at it, of course. I have collaborated on with other movies, actually largely initially with my wife, who used to work full-time as a feature film editor as well. And we, when our children were small, we did a number of projects together, like We're No Angels for Neil Jordan, because she had worked with Neil before. And so it worked very well when there was an understanding of that nature. So when I met Jeremiah and was invited on to work for Bob, we immediately got on, and we literally worked in parallel with Bob in his non-shooting days. We would take scenes individually. We never cut each other's work or recut each other's work. We would stuck to what we were given, and we would comment on each other's work, but we literally worked in parallel. And it was just a joy, and it went, I believe, very, very well, certainly from my point of view. And I learned a lot from Bob and from Jeremiah, and it was just a joyous experience. In fact, we worked so well that when the shoot was over, which is probably when we initially thought that my part would be terminated, it had worked so well, we felt we could push on ahead. And I actually did a good deal of the post-production as well, up until the end of August, when the film was presented to the studio. They're just completing it now with all the VFX and dubbing and so on. So that's how it worked, really. It was just a joy, and I thoroughly enjoyed the collaboration, and I felt like I'd fallen into a family of very like-minded filmmakers, and it was a great experience.
That's awesome. I mean, yeah, I'm certainly very excited to see the film. I think it looks really cool, and it's definitely one of my favorite milieus. You know, that the historical drama action sort of thing. What was it like to sort of get involved in that type of a film? You know, you look at your amazing credits. You've certainly worked on some epically scaled movies, but this one seems somewhat you know, different in terms of some of the other things that you've worked on. Was this a genre that you maybe wanted to try, or is there, you know, when you're looking at projects, do you look for something in particular, or?
Not really. I mean, it didn't feel, it's more an emotional thriller in the sense, or tragedy, you know. I didn't feel at all far away in my understanding of it, of a genre. It felt very, it felt very close to home. In fact, perhaps another connection was that Steve Knight, who wrote this picture, was a friend of mine who had written a film I made with Stephen Frears. I don't know if you mentioned, I can't remember, Dirty Pretty Things.
Oh, yeah.
Because I knew Steve and I knew his writing and I admired his writing, I was already very attracted to it when I realized that there was going to be an opportunity to work with Bob and Jeremiah, Steve Starkey, and that the writer was somebody I knew. As it turned out, in the whole course of making the project, I never saw Steve. We corresponded, but I never actually got to see him. But I knew his work and his sensibility. So in that way, the sensibility of the writing and the intentions of the movie were close to my heart.
Very cool. Yeah. And again, it just, it looks exciting and, looks very stylish. And obviously, you know, Zemeckis has been such an interesting filmmaker over the last 10, 15 years, you know, going back and forth between the motion capture, the all CGI stuff, and then, you know, recently getting it back. What'd you say?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's always, he's just a giant of experimentation and sensibility and craftsmanship. And, you know, apart from being a wonderful man to work with and learn from, I feel in this 6 months that we were together that I learnt an enormous amount. I mean, you never stop learning making films. Each film is a prototype, one that hasn't been made before. And you all start on this kind of incredible journey to try and discover what that movie is. And hopefully you find its real heart.
Mick, I had a question for you. You mentioned doing the effects, you know, after you've done your cut. Can you speak a little bit to how technology, especially in the digital age, how that's changed what you do?
Yeah, it's a difficult one because for films like, I mean, to a greater extent nowadays, all films have a visual effects content, even if it's not apparent to the eye in the sense that it's like the dragons that I had in the Harry Potter film or something, you know, that's created entirely in the CG world. It may just be, as in the case of Allied, creating wartime London or, you know, aeroplanes flying overhead, that kind of thing. Or they might be, you know, they might be very discreet visual additions. In fact, in Allied, a lot of the sets we had in London were for North Africa or something like that. You know, you're just filling in backgrounds and they're not immediately obvious to the audience, we hope. But the conditions that creates in the turning over or the editorial process is that the shots have to be committed in length pretty early on for this manufacturing of the additional visual material. So this is why this project needed extra editorial help early on, in order that there would be time for Bob and the others to create these worlds and the wartime Britain in this case. It takes a long time to manufacture these things. So the visual cut has to be resolved and worked as far as it can, because you don't want to be creating all that additional visual material and then changing the cut and throwing away all the digital work that's been done, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a balance between furthering the cut, getting comfortable with the cut as early as possible, and what we say, what we call locking it up, getting it locked and everybody signed off so that the next stage of visual development can take place. Now, that wasn't the case 20 years ago, 25 years ago, because, you know, the images were created in the camera. What you got in the cutting room was it. And so you could, you know, add 20 feet of a shot without there being a cost implication because it was there in the trims. Nowadays, of course, you can't do that with digital material without a lot of expense, and that has to be avoided if possible. I mean, we do make changes, but it's a question of trying to further the precision of the cut as far as it can go by the time this visual world is added to each image. Because each frame is a costly thing. Sometimes it works, and sometimes we make mistakes and have to readjust as best we can. But generally, the need to resolve the cut, or the literally to the frame, as precisely as possible, as early as possible, is now a demand. Mm-hmm. I hope that makes sense. It's difficult to explain outside of the cutting room, but.
Absolutely. No, it certainly does. With that much money and that many different, I know that on some of these larger, I mean, you've worked on some pretty large films in the digital age, the Harry Potter movie, Everest, you know, things like that, where there's a lot of different players. If you look at the credits on any of those films, you'll see multiple visual effects companies. So I'm sure you have to have a very tight game in order to hand it off to them and not just have a big mess.
The film editing problem or strain, if you like, the difficulty, and if I may use Everest as an example, was that if you think of the first stage of photography that, in this case, Salvatore did, was, you know, perhaps two men on a mound of salt in climbing gear with green drapes behind them. And a wind machine, so you couldn't hear the dialogue to make everything move as if you're at the top of the mountain at Everest. Now, you can cut those things and put them together with all the angles and say, okay, in the background, what is green, all green, is going to be the Himalayas. It's going to be the view from 28,000 feet up Everest. Now, you can imagine that, and you can cut it with this supposition that you know what that's going to look like, even if you may have stills or drawings or whatever. But when the movie plays, and at that stage it's still all green, you don't feel the movie. You don't feel the experience at all. And it's very hard to put yourself in the editorial driving seat for conducting the rhythms of the film and the feelings of it with the sound that maybe you haven't got yet either, and half of the frame is not there visually, to put yourself in the shoes of the audience who's going to be feeling this in 6 months' time or a year's time. That's the difficulty. And I found that very difficult on that film, because you had to allow and trust that the rhythms, which sometimes may be slow or long, would be supported by this experience of being up there, which you would want when you saw all that visual material. Now, as we got further down the process, it gets easier because you start to see the beginnings of this visual work come in, and you start to have a little understanding of what it's going to feel like in your heart, you know, when you sit in the dark and watch it and you're experiencing it. But early on, when you're committing these shots and deciding what you're going to see editorially, it's a very, very difficult ride. Or I personally find it very difficult. I'm sure the other editors I've spoken to suffer from the same anxieties.
Sure. Well, it makes sense in this day and age. Yeah. I mean, and how many of your, let's say, last 10 films do you have that feeling of really trying, of having to keep the final product just in your imagination because what's on the screen in front of you is green?
Yeah, it's becoming increasingly, as I said earlier, it's the norm. I mean, the Everest film was particularly difficult in that way because you're creating an environment which we didn't have shooting access to literally. We were going to we had a crew that was involved in the Easter 2014 avalanche, you know, that were going to make an ascent to the summit, shooting stuff for us, but that was prevented because of the calamity of the avalanche in 2014 Easter when we were shooting our film. So I think over the last 10 or 15 years, it's getting more and more pronounced, the reliance on post-production additions to the image making process rather than it being done at source.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, jumping back in time, way back in time, when you didn't have to worry about such things, I noticed, you know, early in your career, it looks like you formed some pretty good long-standing relationships with Mike Newell and Stephen Frears.
Yeah.
Obviously, they've cut a lot of great films for those two. I was wondering if you could just talk about how you came to work with them and talk about your relationships with those two great filmmakers.
Yeah, I mean, I was, again, very lucky that I met Stephen Frears back in, I'm kind of hardly believe I'm saying this, but 1981, I think, we met. And he was aware of one of the first sort of feature films that I, or collaborations that I'd had with a wonderful director who's sadly no longer alive, called Bill Douglas. And I collaborated on two films with Bill, who I had met in when I mentioned my early days at the British Film Institute, who was a poet of the cinema and made these extraordinary films about his childhood, which are called My Childhood, My Ainfolk, and My Way Home. He was a Scots filmmaker and much revered in this country and France and around the world as a poet, you know, a sort of single voice. And who has who influenced very much Terence Davis. I don't know if you've heard of Terence Davis.
Mm-hmm.
But Terence was very influenced by Bill, too. But I fell in with Bill in the late 70s. And I think Stephen was looking for someone to work with and knew Bill's work. And somehow, through mutual friends and a coincidence, I believe literally at a Christmas party where a sound editor is working with me, ran into Stephen. And then he said, oh, I'm looking for someone to help me cut a film soon, and my name got thrown in, and I met Stephen, and he offered me a job. Much to my surprise, I hasten to add, because I'd revered him already as a notable TV director of movies, movies for TV at that time, and the one feature film he had made by then. So we sort of fell in together, and you know, here we are. 30 years went by. So I met Mike Newell through Stephen because they were close friends, and I don't think you mentioned it, made a what I think is a lovely film, or very tragic film, a hard-hitting film in 1984 called Dance with a Stranger, with Miranda Richardson and Rupert Everett. And so I met Mike through Stephen, and you know, they were good enough to come back when projects came up and I was free, and that's how it worked. A lot of it is chance, in the sense that availability plays a big part in whether you can actually jump on at the right time and the film's dates stay on course. But you know, I was lucky. These people educated me as much as I worked with them, and I felt I had a like-mindedness to sensibilities that we shared, and that's how we've, I guess, soldiered on over the years. And hopefully, they've enjoyed it as much as I've enjoyed being with them.
Yeah, one of your earliest credits with Stephen Frears is The Hit, and
yeah.
I'm curious to sort of hear a little bit about that. It's one of my favorite, you know, crime gangster, cool gangster genre movies, like that, in that realm. And I just think it's such a fantastic movie. And I'm curious to know what the experience was like working on that, and any tidbits that you can share working on The Hit.
Surely. I think fondly of it. It was actually, I think, the first cinema film I did with Stephen, because I did at least one or two 70-minute TV dramas with him before that, but it was the first cinema film that I can remember. And look, I get to hang out with Eric Clapton on that one, so you know, that was pretty cool. So yeah, it was a pleasurable experience. What really happened was that it was a road movie that they shot, making the journey that is shown in the movie. So really, I was in London, receiving daily from wherever they were film that was processed. I wasn't near them, so Stephen and I started a relationship during the shooting where he would rely on me viewing the material and talking him through it on a daily basis, because they were not anywhere, they were always moving and nowhere near anywhere they could kind of see stuff easily. So that's how we started to have, what, if you like, a kind of telephone daily, two or three times a day, daily conversation about the material that I was receiving and the material that I was putting together. And Stephen knew the material he'd shot very, very well, and he would trust me to pick up on or discuss what I was getting out of it, you know, and what observations I had on all the issues that are relevant at that stage of making a film. And so that's how we started this kind of long distance, by virtue of necessity, way of working, that I would be his eyes and ears with the material as received in film on the screen form. You know, he knew it all. He knew what he'd got, but he was interested to know what I was getting out of it and what I was choosing from it. And so that's how we started a dialogue. And even actually later in the films, when we were working perhaps in the same city or close together, or we would keep up that routine of just talking through the material I'd seen and the material I was putting together. So that's kind of cemented the relationship, I guess, from a practical point of view. But it was a fun film. I loved it. I loved all the ideas in it. There was actually talk of us making a modern version of it a couple of years ago, if you can believe
that. Oh, really?
Yeah,
I can see that happening, because the movie's taken on a cult appreciation here in the States.
Yeah.
I was too young to see it, obviously, when it was first released, so I sort of came to it,
yeah,
you know, over the last 10 years or so. The Criterion Collection put it out.
That's right.
And you know, it's one of those things where you'd worked on a couple of, like you said, made for TV films, and then you did The Hit. Was there?
Yeah.
Did you have, when you were making The Hit or working on it, was there any sort of, you know, mental indication to you that your relationship with Stephen would blossom into, you know, what it eventually would be, you know, became? Did you get that impression that you would just?
I didn't. I think I realized that that I had a lot to learn from him. And again, it's a sort of like-mindedness that we seem to be able to talk a shorthand. I never really thought, and I still don't actually think beyond the film that you're making. It's always such a, to use the Everest analogy, each film is a sort of mountain you have to climb in order to get the best view. But I didn't really think that far ahead. I just loved the material. I loved the way it was being shot. You know, John Hurt and Timmy Roth Laura, all those people, the writing, again, it was such a wonderful piece of writing and still resonates in it. And perfectly structured film, you know, it starts with a problem, you know. He shops his mates, and when are they gonna come and get him? one thing that would be interesting for you to know is that I remember very clearly showing the first cut. You know, when they got back from Spain, I had within a few days had a version of the movie to present my work, which obviously I was very nervous about. And Jeremy Thomas, the producer, had also in his career been an editor, so I felt I was a bit on show. Anyway, we showed the film, and it was a little bit long, but it played great. And Stephen said to me afterwards, "Well, that's great. You've made a cut which biases Willie Parker, you know, who is who's captured. But I think we should make a film about Mr. Braddock, about him as the hitman, and switch the emphasis." And I thought, "Wow, that's really interesting. How do I do that?" So that was the first conversation, and he said, "Right, well, I'll see you in a few weeks' time."
And he just left you to figure it out. Huh?
Yeah, I did quite a lot. We talked a lot, though. Yeah, it's not fair to say that he left me just to do it, because we were constantly talking. But yeah, he's always been very supportive and saying, "Look, just follow your instincts, go with it. And then we would obviously sit and discuss the work as it grew and changed and developed, you know, on a daily basis. So it was great fun. But what a wonderful piece of writing, you know, and all the ideas, the whole, you know, the Lennon thing, the spirituality about how could you have a better story about a man who, when he's come, where they come for him, has accepted his fate, supposedly. So, you know, all the work had been done in the way they shot it. It was beautifully shot by Mike Malloy, you know, great, great cameraman. And the whole thing was just a joy. Economically done, beautiful performances. The sort of stuff of dreams, for me, anyway.
Mm-hmm. At the time when you were making these films, would you characterize them as lower budget? Were you guys kind of, scrimping for every penny as far as getting the production off the ground?
Yeah, I think perhaps by some standards today. I mean, there's always that at that time was particularly expressed, I think, in, you know, the amount of time that you have. Although I don't remember rushing in particular, but it was very much, we've got, you know, 22 weeks from beginning to end, and that's it. So there's not going to be a penny more after that. I think that, I mean, they were all relatively low budget films, but the pleasure of low budget films is that we could do in a way what we wanted. Mm-hmm. You know, and we had a very supportive executive producership. People supported the film for what it was. Nobody tried to make another film, if you know what I mean, halfway along. We all knew what we wanted to go for. And that is a privilege.
And to compare and contrast that, because obviously you have worked on some huge studio projects at this point in your career, you know, many of them. Do you have a preference? Do you prefer the freedom of being on a low budget compared to the big studio tentpoles?
I don't think, oddly enough, all films feel like they haven't got enough money, even if it's got $120 million or you know, $120,000. It's just there is always pressure from one sort or another. If I'm honest, I like the contrast between the different factors that are involved as a filmmaker in, you know, the issues and problems that need to be solved on a big film and a small one. I haven't really got a preference, if I'm honest. They throw up different things, different problems, different emphases, and different concerns, and hopefully we do our best to try and solve them to the best within those constrictions, parameters, or budget. But it would amuse you to know that even expensive films sometimes feel that they have budgetary constraints and worries and so on. They do. Yeah,
gotcha.
You might have to worry about not using too many pencils from the stationery cupboard, you know.
Right.
Yeah, when you're working on a Jerry Bruckheimer production, they're not watching out for, you know, plastic cups or something.
No, but, you know, there are pressures then to make the film succeed in a particular marketplace and at a particular level and perform. So you've got other pressures. You may have, you know, the ability to reshoot some shots or even a scene or you know, whatever. But you've got to do that within the constraints of make it succeed at the level that films with those sorts of budgets, you know, procure.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask about one other filmmaker. I mean, there's several we could ask about, but I'm a huge Terry Gilliam fan.
Oh, yeah. And,
you know, a couple of your credits here, obviously, seem like they would present very unique editing challenges. With Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, I've read pretty extensively on, obviously, you know, Heath Ledger's untimely passing and how that affected the production and how that affected your job. And also with 12 Monkeys, what it's like to do so much jumping around, you know, in time.
Yeah.
If you could speak to both of those productions, I'd love to hear about
them. Sure. Well, let me go sort of chronologically backwards. Of course, the experience of being 4 weeks into the Imaginarium and poor Heath's passing, where the shock of that went through us all of what had happened, and at the stage, it happened at a stage where we were had finished shooting in London, we were due to set up in Vancouver to do the blue screen work. It was a split finance, if I recollect correctly. And the shooting, which was going to be largely blue screen, was allotted to Vancouver. And there was a little gap of about 5 days where we finished shooting in London, and then we were going to regroup and travel and get set up. And Heath's death in New York was, I think, on the Tuesday of that week, where we were due to get ready in Vancouver by the Thursday and start shooting again the following Monday. So my first thoughts, I remember, were, oh, that's the end of our film. This can't move forward anymore. And then dear Terry, being the tenacious and wonderful person that he is, said, look, why don't we go into the cutting room and see what we've got and figure out whether there's a route through this to continue with, and at that point, another actor, Johnny Depp. And because of the conceit of the film, we knew that there was this mirror. And I don't know how familiar you are with the movie, but we were really only one scene short, as we called it, this side of the mirror. And there were masks involved. So we realized quite quickly that there was a way of completing the one side of the mirror, and that if the conceit of a transformation of character took place on the other side, that would possibly be a route to complete the movie. And Terry, in his wonderfully imaginative way, reconceived, you know, the script. I think we had a week under an insurance duress, actually. The production was halted, and we had a week in the cutting room to figure out whether that was possible, and he came up with a draft that would allow this shift. It then became apparent, if I recollect correctly, that availabilities within the time frame, because remember, we had a stop date. We couldn't keep the whole thing going, you know, much beyond a stretch of a couple of weeks, I think. So the dates, you know, we had a sort of, there was a brick wall at the other end. So we had to move quickly, and because of those schedules, it then became apparent that one Johnny, in this case, wasn't going to be available to do the amount of shooting we needed to complete the movie. So that's when the idea of the others coming in, and that it was going to be several switches, all within the conceit of this imagined world, which, you know, to this day, because it was such an emotional kind of trip, the whole making of the film, I can't say personally how well that succeeds or fails, or if it fails completely, I don't know, because I haven't been able to look at the film without reliving all the difficulties we had making it.
Sure.
But we did get through, and it got made thanks to Terry and God knows Amy, his daughter. I mean, it was just an incredible effort on everybody's part to actually complete the movie and do it within the budgetary constraints and the insurance wrangles that followed, which were endless. You know, the costing
and make
of
it
what...
feel organic, and make it feel organic given the change. And that's the thing. And that's the thing that I've always felt about the movie that's so unique is that unless you knew about all the issues and the problems and the rewrites, in my head, there's the movie feels as if it were made that way.
Yeah, so I do hope so. Well, that's an incredible that's great to hear. And again, I can only put that down to Terry's tenacity and vision and sheer hard work and pulling us and everybody through to put his signature on it in a way which it has that sort of coherence. But I'll be honest with you, the last time I saw the movie, which was shortly after it was finished, Terry happened to be in California while I was working there, and he had a showing, and I went, and I saw it completely finished and printed. And I found it very difficult to judge because all I could see was the way we had to divert, you know, because of the issues involved. So actually, it may be time to go and look at it again. I think it's a nice movie, and of course it has the wonderful, you know, it has great performances and all the rest of it.
It does. Yeah. I have to be a fan for a minute here and just say it's one of my favorites that Gilliam's ever done.
Really?
And
that's great to hear.
Extremely successful. I think that it's just a lovely kind of tribute to the art of storytelling and imagination and fantasy. So, yeah, I think you guys really stuck the landing on what clearly was one of the more troubled productions.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether Terry has ever talked at length, or I mean, he could write a book about it. I know I could, about what we went through, certainly from my point of view, and he went through 10 times more than I did personally. You know, so yeah, but again, it's the drive of the story, in this case, this wonderful, you know, world that only Terry can create, and his dedication to you know, these wonderful imagined narratives and the performances we had, you know, Chris and all of those people, that everybody just threw themselves in, you know. It was great. It was great. And so that makes my job much, 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 much easier in the end. You have to have strong material.
Sure. At the end of the day, you only have what they hand to you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's some kind of feeling on the street that we can do magic, and well, there is an alchemy involved in the editorial process. But you know, my real belief is that if you haven't got sort of strong performances at a certain level, it's very hard to reinvent them. You can make good performances very good, but performances that aren't so good are very hard to reinvent. So if you're getting great material from great performances, then our job is considerably easier.
I was just going to say, in terms of great performances and working with Terry Gilliam, I mean, I'm a huge Terry Gilliam fan, and I'll second what Tim said about Imaginarium. I think it's a wonderful movie, and I think it's one of the more underrated movies overall in his career. I think that people were too probably hung up on, unfortunately, the sadness of Heath Ledger's death and the sort of the commotion that caused for all you guys making the movie. But 12 Monkeys for me is it's a masterpiece. I've seen it 20 times. I can remember seeing it in a theater with my father when I was 15, like it was yesterday. I think it's just one of the absolute great time travel science fiction narratives of my lifetime, of anybody's lifetime. I've been fascinated with the movie for years. Bruce Willis's performance was absolutely amazing. One of his best, one of his most underrated performances. When you were getting the footage back and editing that movie, what was your initial thought, and did you sense the brilliance immediately?
I think so. I mean, actually, it's one of those funny stories. Just that I actually knew the script about, if I remember again correctly, 2 years before, because I had worked with David Peoples, who wrote, or he was David and Jan, it's a man and wife team, wrote the, you know, the screenplay and the if you like, they took the Chris Marker notion and developed it into what it is. But I knew David from a collaboration a few years earlier, which was the film called Hero, which I made with Stephen Frears in the early 90s.
Love that movie.
So yeah. I knew David, and in fact, we became friends, and they were kind enough to send me a draft of 12 Monkeys about 18 months or 2 years before it went into production. And I thought, I would kill to make this film. It's so interesting, and it's going to be difficult, but I was desperate to do it. Now, life usually doesn't go this way, but it was my good fortune that I not only knew the script, but it came to Terry, and Terry very generously came to me, and I was free, and everything clicked. So I would jump to board, you know, without any hesitation. So I knew the thing very well. I was also incredibly excited by the filmmaking challenges that I knew it would produce. But as soon as the material came in, I started to feel a sense of, sort of wonder at the whole thing. Because Terry was getting this very new Bruce Willis persona. Brad, who I had worked with before on the vampire film, was doing something I had never seen before at that time. And so it was very exciting and very... I used to go home sort of shaking with excitement, you know, putting the stuff together. But I think that if there was a concern, it was that we could tell that story in a way sufficiently articulately that it wouldn't throw you out. You know, it had to be like a labyrinthine maze. And the editorial challenges were going to be huge. I knew to articulate it. But I have to say that I got a lot of credit for that, but which is not really founded, because it was written so beautifully, and Dave and Jan did a great deal of work on that, just on the pages. You know, we did move things around, of course, and balance things in the editorial process, but you know, the piece, if you were to read the original or the draft that we shot, it's not that dissimilar. That's my memory anyway, from what we put on the screen editorially. There was a running joke, of course, that the flashbacks in the airport, were distributed that in a way which the original idea was that you increasingly got information and started to piece together these little fragments, shards of memory and so on. And they would pull my leg about it, saying, "Mick, have you put this stuff in yet? You know, where have you put it?" Mm-hmm. And I would say, I'm getting on all right. And in fact, I hadn't done anything. I'd left it on the shelf because I didn't know where to put it yet or how much I should put in. So I had to bluff my way through that until it got too late. And then I had to dive in and just start. But it was a sort of constant combing through. But why I felt I benefited from the writing was that the structure of that idea, we're going to piecemeal feed information until you get it all at the last minute, was the guiding line as to how we progressed editorially. I had an analogy, which was that, you know, when you see sort of bathwater going down the plug hole, it goes faster and faster, and then, bong, it drops down, or like a ball in a snooker or game or something like that. That was my sort of metaphor or image in my head, that if we could not alienate the audience by these bits of information which don't initially cohere, but they gradually grow, or you understand more, and then eventually, it all drops in and you get it. That was the task. So that helped me through. But that design was really put in place by the writing and Terry's, you know, direction, really.
I'll tell you what, that editing has always stood out to me, though. It feels like the rollouts and just the way those images come together and eventually explain things is just kind of a masterclass in the editing room. So you stuck the landing.
That's great. Well, it was funny because it was we, as a group of filmmakers, I don't know if you've ever seen the little documentary about us making it, The Hamster Factor, which is a wonderful portrait of what was going on, which accompanies the movie. It's a great little piece and shows exactly how the climate in which we were making that film. And it happened to be, for me, the last film I cut on film. So it was at the end of that sort of analog era. So it's again, that's a great thing as a movie to have. It's... We previewed the film, and we were all very fond of it and you know, close to it and its ambitions. And initially, the responses we got were not positive. You know, they were rather lukewarm. And we were all very dispirited by that, as that little documentary shows. We tested the film, and the reactions were lukewarm, really, you know, not terribly enthusiastic. And we couldn't believe it, because we all felt it was such an interesting thing and such a unique piece of work. And again, surprisingly, perhaps by nowadays, the studio, Universal, were wonderful, and they said, look, you guys must just carry on. And that's what we did. We like this. You must just finish it. Follow your noses. And we did, which I think was an incredible leap of faith. And then as soon as it was finished, we started to realize that this was going to have, seemed to have a great deal of resonance, and people were intrigued and wanted to go and see the film several times. So I guess we had solved those issues of the balance between the intrigue of the story and its complexity, and not alienating the audience and pushing them away, and that they would disconnect. So, yeah, you know, it was a fascinating journey to go through.
I want to ask you one more question about 12 Monkeys before you tell us a bit about Sprocket Rocket Soho and what that's about. One of the many, many things about 12 Monkeys that's always really stood out for me. And obviously it's a, you know, the movie's plenty old, so I'm not really running the risk of spoilers, but, the end scene, on the plane where the woman says, I'm in insurance.
Yes.
The line still gives me a chill. I still laugh. I still snicker. I still just think it's one of like those great movie moments. And one of the things that, I've paid attention to throughout the years, it's a small thing. It's probably a movie geek thing. It's literally when a line of dialogue is important, and how long an editor and a filmmaker decide to hold on that particular shot, and why you edit, when you edit. And one of the things, not only the name of that actress right now, of course, is escaping me. Not only is her line delivery perfect, but the way that you guys held that shot and allowed it to have the right amount of space and the right amount of time for her words to sink in, that's what I think has made it so, for me, so iconic. When you're faced with a crucial moment in a film and, you know, how long to hold a shot, what's that like as an editor?
It can give you sleepless nights. It's what I call a bedroom ceiling editing. You lie in bed and think, what is this going to feel like to an audience that's never seen it, and what value and weight do I give it? I have to say that you'll be amused to know that in those test screenings that I've just mentioned, where we got very average responses initially to that film, almost complete. It was pretty much complete, apart from some technical things. You'll be interested to know that we screened the film literally one day. I think it was one day twice. Once with that ending that you've just mentioned, and once without it, because we wondered, we were unsure as to whether that just sent you off, you know, on a track which was going to be not beneficial. As it turned out, we discovered that the responses to the movie and as a whole, with or without it, were unchanged. So we left it in because we liked it, and then the weight that we gave it editorially, I think, was probably based on a guess, which I often do, which is to try. You have to have screened the whole movie. You can't do it in isolation, so you're always adjusting it when you witness the whole movie at a run. So you might, you know, you go to work on a Monday morning or something, you look at it and think, God, this is a bit long. You know, I need to trim it, or what does it really need? But you adjust that when you sit and you've sat with an audience and you watch the whole thing and you feel it and you think, oh, hold on a minute, they need a bit more here. This is not landing. And perhaps to answer your question as succinctly as I can, I'm very reliant on the feeling you get in a room or in a cinema with those tests where you've got 300 or 400 people and you're feeling whether you're getting what you want across. And I think, although we only previewed that film, I think, 2 or 3 times, definitely twice with and without the ending, and one other time, we do have screenings for friends, and we, you know, show it to people we trust, and it's those experiences where you harness what you feel the energy is in the cinema, and make the adjustments that you need editorially thereafter. So you kind of, like a concert, you know, it's like a live show. And it's easier with things which are funny because you can hear people laugh or not, or boo or scream. but with something like that, you've got to feel whether you think this stuff is landing and whether things have got the right weight or length, if you like, to land correctly. And that's something you can't really teach. It's something you feel. And I feel it very strong. Perhaps an example would be, I don't know, perhaps you as filmmakers, if you show somebody something, it can just be two of you in the room. It's different to you. You get a sense from them of how it's playing, how it's being received. If you multiply that by 400 or 500 people, you get a very strong sense of the response. Negative, positive, all kinds of things. And I try and pick up on that and record it in my head and let that sort of be a guiding light to me for what I'm going to do next, because there may be lots of other voices that come in and try and influence that reaction or give their own. And you have to hold on to what's true to yourself, and it's that feeling in your guts, in it, you know, what you want it to be, what you want the audience to be feeling. And that's my sort of guiding route for the next stage. So I think very much with that one. I probably mucked about with it quite a lot. I can't remember, if I'm honest, but gauging the weight of something like that would have to be as a result of seeing and living through the whole film with an audience and feeling what they want by the time they get to that point, 120 minutes in, something like that. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's great perspective.
Tell us about Sprocket Rocket. What's this all about? And
yeah.
How did this come
up? Well, it's interesting to mention 12 Monkeys, because that being the the end of film editing for me, in the sense of actually handling film in what we call cutting rooms. Now people call them edit suites. I don't think I've ever worked in one of those. They're usually rather funny old places with paint coming off the walls, you know. So I call them cutting rooms. But in this, I think it's probably just over 20 years. Let's say 20 years that we've finished 12 Monkeys. So in this digital transformation, which is sort of wonderful, and you know, who could not embrace as a filmmaker the ability to put multiple soundtracks up against your images very quickly, to have instant access to all the imagery you've got. It's fantastic. But perhaps a byproduct of the online age is that we've all started to work more in isolation. Certainly in my filmmaking career, the time of 12 Monkeys, the doors, other cutting rooms nearby were open, and we shared the material we were making as it grew more openly. I think physically also the apprenticeship system has changed, because, for example, in the editorial side of filmmaking, say on 12 Monkeys, I would have an assistant editor or a second assistant editor or even a trainee helping me manipulate and move the physical film around while we were editing it. And those created conversations and sharing of our ups and downs with a director and editor and an assistant in the room. So you had an apprenticeship where we all kind of sound each other out, share ideas. It's just the nature of working together on a film. Now, we tend to work in the non-linear systems, you know, with Avid and so on, which are terrific. But we are working in a room on our own, with shared storage. And so what I'm driving at here is that I felt in the last 10 years that filmmakers, certainly in the editorial side and to a greater degree in all departments, were not meeting as frequently and sharing filmmaking ideas. We don't necessarily have dailies anymore. That used to be requisite during a shoot every night, say on 12 Monkeys, we'd all meet, sometimes cast as well, to see what we'd done the day before and talk it through. Now people are watching things on pads or phones. Material can fly about from country to country, so you're not actually physically meeting. So this isolation led me to want to create, certainly here in London initially, and with my wife, who's also a filmmaker, an editor, was to just create occasions where we got people together to start sharing ideas, and each other's company, not just editorial, but meeting other producers, other, you know, whatever, and talking film and our excitement for it through. So we started to arrange get-togethers here in London, which were very popular, and people came back saying, oh, when are you going to do one of these again? And so we've now set up something a little bit more organized through a website, and we do screenings of ideas and thoughts about filmmaking with key people that I've met, and then we perhaps gather afterwards for a drink and talk these things through. So it's a way of sharing an education of each other and bringing younger filmmakers and more seasoned ones, shall I put it that way, of my age group, together, because we can all learn from each other. And we've had fantastic response, and it's not just here in Britain. You know, we do little online videos to share ideas as well. So it's been growing because there seems to be a need for people to reconnect, preferably together in one space and talk. And if it has to be just online, well then, but with regular meetings as well. I hope that explains it as best as I can.
Yeah, and I mean, it seems essentially that something that was born out of you know, the new new necessity in our digital age.
Absolutely, and what was surprised Yoko, my wife, and I about this whole endeavor is that we found the minute that we started to bring people together, they very much responded by saying, oh, why hasn't anybody else done this? We there's a great need to share, to talk, to be in a room together, to get excited about things. So some of the talks, for example, we did one about 2 weeks ago, which was courtesy of the wonderful Dolby Institute, who made it possible for us to use their theatre in London, was to bring together a composer, a sound designer, and a dubbing mixer, myself, together, show some clips that we felt illustrated issues to do with how the thinking and thought process goes for soundtracks in general. We took examples which illustrate the thinking, and with an audience of about 65 people, which is small enough for us to all interact, we show things, we talk, we discuss, and then we all discuss it with them, and then we all get together afterwards and share thoughts and you know, meet one another one to one with this core of an idea, and that's really how it's been taking off. And I'm you know, very happy if people contact us or get in touch with us to share this you know, ability to cross-fertilize each other's excitement with filmmaking, young and old.
Excellent.
Awesome.
Mick, can you give us the website address?
Yes, it's www.sprocketrocketsoho.com.
Perfect.
Everybody check it out?
Please do check it out. And it's if you are, we have many friends in the States. We are hoping that we will at some stage create some similar events in LA and New York, where we have many filmmaking friends, and do some similar events in the future. But please don't be hesitant to register if you live abroad, because it just means you're part of the network and you receive the stuff that we're doing. And we're going to be doing more of our sort of like 2 or 3 minute videos, which are, again, you know, experts like you know, experts giving their knowledge on filmmaking issues. And well, we're lucky enough that Robert Zemeckis very kindly gave me an interview, which we're cutting at the moment. So, you know, Robert will be there talking about you know, things that he's learned about being a director, and or Jeremiah did a beautiful one about, you know, his thoughts of being a film editor. It's merely all of us sharing our experiences, and hopefully we interchange ideas.
Sounds like anybody who's a budding filmmaker or anybody a part of this world definitely needs to check out your site. It sounds like you're doing a good thing that, you know, seems overdue.
Yeah, and hopefully, you know, certainly if people are in London, as I say, the events go up, you know, with a month's warning or a couple of months' warning, and people can come along and join in. And even if I think ultimately, perhaps even we may have to do some podcasts.
There you go.
Got to get a podcast for the thing. Absolutely. Well, Mick, thank you so much. And we want to be respectful of your time. We could probably talk to you for a couple of hours, but this has been a treat. We're of course, extremely pumped to see Allied. We'll be hyping that up for sure as it gets closer to release. And just again, just an absolute honor to talk to you about your amazing work. Thank you so much.
It's a great pleasure. Oh, it's been a great pleasure to talk to both of you. And please, if I can be, I've got a little gap now before my next project, which is mid-November. So, if you need more time from me, we can always do this again. It'd be my pleasure.
Oh, much appreciated. Oh. We may well take you up on that.
Maybe we will. Maybe we'll just get you on. We'll talk about one of your favorite movies or something like that.
Absolutely, because I feel it's hard to recall everything about movies that are 20 or 30 years ago, but I hope some of it's of use.
Oh, it's been great. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and trust us, we've been very fortunate through the website to attract some very loyal fans, and people really do seem to enjoy these chats, especially with the editors and the cinematographers that we speak with, because, you know, you guys really are the ones that are sort of putting these movies together. Obviously, it's a collaborative effort, but, you know, we're just so excited that so many great people have talked to us, and I think that people will really enjoy it. So thank you again. Really appreciate it, and you know that I'll be keeping in touch.
That's great. And just to say that, you know, filmmakers can contact us through the website that we've given you. There's an email address there. I won't bore you with that now. But it is just in order to us to feel that people of a certain stature or experience are not miles away, because we've all been young, starting out filmmakers or wherever, and we all need to learn from each other.
Excellent.
All right. I'll say goodbye.
All right. Thanks, Mick. We really appreciate your time.
Goodbye, Nick.
Thank you.
Goodbye, Tim. And I'll speak to you again soon, I do hope.
Great.